Well, what we're going to look at today is the matter of Christian providence, protecting us from greed and envy. And the focus of this lesson is that God provides for us providentially. And what we have is given to us by God, so what we have is enough. But we should use what we have in God-honoring ways. I'm going to kind of treat this in reverse order. I'm not going to talk so much about greed and envy, but about the providence of God. But I will mention this about greed and envy. Clearly, they're both serious problems, right? They're sins. Colossians 3, verse 5, for example, says that greed is idolatry. I think, are more blind to that in our culture than we may be willing to admit. But greed can manifest itself in various ways. In fact, greed, it's not just money, but it could be, you know, want for anything that doesn't rightfully belong to us. Greed is a serious threat to our lives as Christians, not only to our lives as individual Christians, but to our lives as a congregation, right? as Christian family in a local church. As strange as it is, Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 5, right? That we should have nothing to do with a greedy person, with a greedy brother. Anybody ever heard of a case of a church withdrawing from somebody for greed? I never have. And I admit, that's probably going to be pretty challenging to do, but perhaps it is the attitude and the behaviors that are manifested. But he also goes on to say that the greedy will not inherit God's kingdom in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 10. It's a serious issue. And particularly for us, in the United States of America, who love money, who love stuff, and who love prestige, and who always want more and more and can't be content with what we have. That is the message, one of the messages of our culture. And the matter of envy is perhaps a sister sin here, but envy is kind of addressed in the 10th commandment, right, to not covet. But the issue there is being discontent with what we have and with God's provisions for us. What God's commandment in not coveting promotes is actually rejoicing with those who do have maybe things that I don't have, and sharing in their gladness that God has blessed them in a way. And that the negative side can manifest itself when we are perhaps glad for someone's misfortune. It didn't happen to us, or they got what was coming to them. Perhaps envy could also be manifested in being jealous that Marshall gets to preach here full time and I don't, right? I'm jealous in perhaps Marshall's abilities, right? Preachers wrestle with this. Public teachers and leaders wrestle with this sort of thing as well. So it's a serious problem, and we've got to do some serious thinking about this, and there's no way I could cover everything and every aspect of this issue, but I want to challenge us to at least begin to think about this very seriously and biblically. One person has made this observation, Michael Goheen, who kind of studies this sort of thing, that and studies how, you know, different cultures around the world. He's a Bible believer, but he made this observation that. Just speaking broadly, generally, that Western Christianity, right, in Europe and the United States, is the most syncretistic version, broadly speaking, of Christianity in the world. And what that means is we buy into things that the Bible condemns, and we're blinded to it. And one of them is materialism, in the sense of possessions and accumulation and stuff and money and greed, right? And I've seen this among some of the most godly-minded Christians that I know. Father wants his daughter to marry somebody who makes a lot of money. And that's put, given priority over their devotion to the Lord, right? Their care, their personal character. And we shouldn't be surprised when all kinds of problems crop up because of that. So here's what we're going to do in this lesson. We're going to basically look at two things. We're going to start out broad, look at the broader biblical perspective on a view of our material things, our blessings from the Lord. And then we're going to look at the passage that was suggested to go along with this lesson in Philippians 4 and just make a couple of points out of that. I couldn't let you get away with a 15-minute sermon, right? So I had to fill in some more space. No. Actually, the reason why I want to start with a broader biblical view is to kind of help set the context of a passage like Philippians and to show that there is a common theme throughout the Bible that's rather consistent. And perhaps the difference between us and other cultures could be a matter of degree, but everybody in every culture and every generation all throughout the world and its history have wrestled with trusting in the Lord's provision. So, first of all, just want to make this note, real brief point, right? Easy to memorize. God provides for us providentially, so we should use what we have in God-honoring ways. I'll say that a million times, and perhaps we may memorize it. I don't know how to summarize it any more succinctly. Well, we're going to look at the bookends here of the Bible, which actually end up being bookends of the history of creation, I guess. From the beginning, God actually provided for the people he created. Right from the get-go, God provided everything that Adam and Eve needed. And in Genesis 2, verse 15, what God had created, Adam was told to take care of it, to guard it and keep it, which is later biblical teaching shows us that that was really kind of a priestly function that Adam was given, but to take care of God's provisions that God has given him. And there's a lot of freedom, but yet there were some rules, right? There were some things that he cannot do. There was a way to misuse God's provision. And that's in Genesis 2, verse 17, right? You don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Tree of knowledge of good and evil, not tree of knowledge, right? This is a moral issue, not intellect. Adam was given these provisions and said, there is a certain way to use what God's given you. There is a way to honor God in the way that you use and take care of the things God's provided for them. Well, what about Revelation 22? Believe it or not, we have the picture that everything is fully restored to the way it was originally designed. And there the tree of life in Revelation 22, verse 2, is there. And what is its purpose? What's the purpose of the tree of life? It brings healing to the nations. Revelation 22, healing to the nations. There is a God-honoring way. There is a purpose or a use in keeping with who God is. That creation is to serve and be used by God and his people according to his ways. And this is in stark contrast with how Babylon is described in Revelation 18, the harlot Babylon. If you want to read with me, perhaps, verses 11 through 16. And Babylon here is probably referring to the city of Rome. But verse 11, this is how the Roman Empire basically functioned and how it used some of the things God created. Revelation 18, verse 11, and the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys her cargo anymore, cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet, cloth of all kinds of scented wood, all kinds of articles of ivory, all kinds of articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses and chariots and slaves, that is human lives. The fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you, and all your delicacies and your splendors are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas, for the great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels, and with pearls. For in a single hour all this wealth has been laid waste. So, does that kind of strike us as a little uncomfortably familiar? That sounds like our society and how it just elevates stuff and misuses it. And the extreme is the misuse of people. The misuse of people. Greed and envy can lead to the exploitation of human beings. And that is also happening in this country. And in some cases, forms of literal slavery. Whether it's women, young men, who are kidnapped, who are taken, and then sold into the sex slave market. They may be transported to other countries. People from around the world are brought in secretly to be misused. And we rightly cringe at such a thought. What about in the meantime, though? Is there a way for us to properly think about God's provisions and properly use them? And Israel provides us with a model that is fulfilled in the church. In Deuteronomy 26, this may be somewhat of a lengthy reading, but it is just worth to kind of set the tone here of what God expects from Israel. In Deuteronomy 26, verses 1 through 15, it says, "When you come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, and have taken possession of it and live in it, you shall take some of the first of all the fruit of the ground, which you harvest from your land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you shall put it in a basket. And you shall go to the place that the Lord your God will choose to make his name to dwell there. And you shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him, 'I declare today to the Lord your God that I have come into the land that the Lord swore to our fathers to give us.' Then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God. And you shall make response before the Lord your God. 'A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians treated us harshly and humiliated us and laid on us hard labor. Then we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great deeds of terror, with signs and wonders. And he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground, which you, O Lord, have given me. And you shall set it down before the Lord your God and worship before the Lord your God. And you shall rejoice in all the good that the Lord your God has given to you and your house, you and the Levite and the sojourner who is among you. When you finish paying all the tithe of your produce in the third year, which is the year of tithing, giving it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your towns and be filled, then you shall say before the Lord your God, I have removed the sacred portion out of my house, and moreover, I have given it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandment that you have commanded me. I have not transgressed any of your commandments, nor have I forgotten them. I have not eaten of the tithe while I was mourning, or removed any of it while I was unclean, or offered any of it to the dead. I have obeyed the voice of the Lord my God. I have done according to all that you have commanded me. Look down from your holy habitation from heaven, and bless your people Israel in the ground that you have given us, as you swore to our fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey." So what is the purpose of these feasts, these celebrations or feast days that Israel was told to observe? And this one's talking particularly about the feast of our fruit, festival of the first harvest, right, the initial harvest. But it really kind of applies to any of these opportunities to bring to Levitical cities or to the temple, what the Lord has blessed them with from this land flowing with milk and honey, this land that God gave them, right? It's God's to give. Well, they're to use it in ways that honor God. And the ways that honor him is, first of all, acknowledging, remembering, basing our actions on what God has done, that God has delivered us. Even we didn't deserve it. He delivered us as Israelites, right, out of Egypt into this land. And how are we to use what God has given us in this land? Share it with the Levites, right, who don't have as much of the land as the Israelites do. They don't have their own, like, portion of land they get to just settle down in, fields and stuff. What about those traveling through, those who aren't native here? Take care of them. What about the fatherless and the widow? You use what God's given you to feed them, to make sure that their needs are provided for. This is how God's providing for them. So here's these God-honoring ways for using what God has given us within the fallen world that we live in. Other passages like Deuteronomy 8 talk about how Canaan is the good land, like Eden was good, or that God's creation was good. It says, even the poor will eat bread without scarcity, and they will lack nothing, right? God is going to provide for all, but they have a responsibility to use what God's given them in ways that honor God. Well, who's true Israel? Right? Those who are circumcised in heart. That's always been the case, but in the New Testament, the church of Jesus Christ is described as the true Israel. In Acts chapter 2, the day of Pentecost, one of these feasts that would be a way of practicing what we've read in Deuteronomy 26. In Acts chapter 2, verse 1, it says, when the day of Pentecost, literally what it says, when the day of Pentecost was fulfilled. It's not that the day of Pentecost, right, now's the time for, you know, that God's just deemed to arbitrarily, you know, to fulfill his purposes and his covenant promises, but it's fulfilled in the sense that other things in the Old Testament are fulfilled in Jesus and in his church. And what do we see after the church begins in Acts 2? This is a summary of just how the church was characterized in Jerusalem. In Acts 2, verse 44, it says, and all who believed were together and had all things in common, and they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all the people. What are these Christians doing? What we read in Deuteronomy 26. They're sharing with their brothers and sisters who have need, right? Even willing to give up their land. They're not being homeless, right? This is probably like extra land that they had. Well, they would sell it so that the brothers and sisters would have what they need. And that's how God provided for them. So they're living out really in accordance with the original purposes in creation. And according to the model first given in the law of Moses, or for example, in Deuteronomy. And that is sort of the biblical larger picture of us using what God provides for us providentially in ways that honor him. And some of those ways is in taking care of those among us who have needs. Well, Psalm 50, verse 12 puts it this simply. The world and its fullness are mine. It's always good for us to think about how we use phrases, right, what they mean. And we kind of develop some stock terminology, right, and whatever we may be kind of spending a lot of time in, whether it's a particular job, IT, people have, you know, certain terminology, and engineers, drummers. But it's also in the church. And when we talk about the Lord's money, what do we mean? It's the treasury, right, of the local church collected together. That's the Lord's money, usually, how we talk about it. Psalm 50, verse 12 says that everything in creation is God's. What is in our bank accounts is God's money. What's in our retirement funds is God's money. Our house is God's house. Our yard, that's God's yard. We're just stewards of it. Everything belongs to God. He's just giving it to us as stewards to take care of, ways in accordance with Him. And Philippians 4 is talking about this sort of thing. It's an example of this sort of thing being practiced. In Philippians 4, verses 10 through 20, we're going to notice 2 points. First of all, we can be content through the strength of Christ. In Philippians 4, verses 10 through 13, it says, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at length you have revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. Not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I've learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low or to be humbled, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. And I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. What Paul is talking about here is that the Philippians, the church in Philippi, has sent Paul some funds. We don't know with absolute certainty all the details, but what seems to make the most sense is that Paul is under house arrest in Rome, probably the Acts 28 arrest in Rome. He's most likely literally chained to a guard. He's not going to be allowed to leave whenever he wants. But how is he going to provide for himself? How is he going to, and Acts 28 says that these are rented quarters, right? He has to pay rent for this. How is he going to get money to do that? And perhaps that the Philippians is sending money to help him in that way, that in a sense they're kind of visiting Paul in prison in this way. They're taking care of something that he can't get on his own. Or, you know, that's not the case. There's any number of reasons why they could have helped him out. There's always need for him to be supported in preaching the gospel. And so what we can say is that they sent him some money to help him in some way. They didn't have an opportunity for a while, but now they do. And they took advantage of that opportunity. Here they are, again, practicing what we've already seen in the creation, or in Deuteronomy 26 or in Acts 2. They're looking out for the interest of Paul and for the furtherance of the gospel. And Paul says that he's not speaking because he's in need, right? He's gotten what he's, perhaps now because he's received payment or because he wasn't in absolute desperate straits when they did send him something, but he's not, being crushed at this point. But he says, I've learned to be content, whatever situation I'm in. I've learned to be content. And in verse 12, when he talks about being brought low, at least that's the ESV translation, the idea is literally he's been humbled. And if we've been reading through Philippians, we remember, oh yeah, Paul talked about humility before in chapters 2, and well, particularly chapter 2. And the central model of humility is Jesus Christ. He humbled himself. The Lord, the creator of everything, lived in humble means and was content. And we're called to imitate Paul as he imitates Christ at the end of Philippians 3. We're called to live lives of cross-bearing, self-sacrifice, in service to God and other people. And what's astonishing about this, that is especially applicable to us in our society, Paul says he's learned to be content in any circumstance, whether he's got plenty or little. But this is the context of verse 13. Why is that important? Well, sometimes we see Philippians 4, verse 13, quoted on all kinds of plaques and things we put on our in our houses and bracelets, you know, jewelry, whatever the case may be. The specific context is talking about money. When he doesn't have a lot of money, Paul is content. Does that make us a little uncomfortable? That I can be content on not getting that job promotion? I can be content making less money this year than I did last year? The name of the game in our society is money, money, money. Profit, profit, profit. Gain, gain, gain. You ask any veteran how offensive this would be. On Memorial Day this year, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, anybody hear about the tweet that MLB sent out? I think that's what it's called, a tweet, right? This is what they said. Today is about honor and respect. Memorial Day, right? Today is about honor and respect. Tip your new era cap to those who sacrificed to keep us safe. What's wrong with that? They're using Memorial Day to make money. They're in a contract with this company, New Era, to sell stuff. Hey, let's use Memorial Day with honor and respect, right? All the sacrifice that these veterans have made, the suffering that they've gone through and their families have gone through, so that we can fill our pockets with as much money as we can. Now, you think they're going to admit that? No, because that's what sin does. It deceives. That is our society. And they're rightly criticized for it. I'm not a communist. I don't think the Bible teaches communism. But we also have to admit that capitalism is not some God-inspired economic system. It may be good and have lots of benefits, but it can also be misused because it is not centered on the God of the Bible. And sometimes we buy into gain, 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 profit, profit, profit at any expense. When we're told here, at least by Paul's example, to be content with what we have. And how can we be content then? What's the solution? And it's really this simple. The Lord provides what we need. The Lord provides what we need. God cares about us and provides what we need. And there's two ways that God provides that we'll look at here. Philippians 4, verse 14 says, "Yet it was kind of you to share my trouble, my affliction. And you, Philippians, yourselves know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I left Macedonia, no church entered into partnership with me in giving and receiving, except you only. Even in Thessalonica, you sent me help for my needs once and again, or more than once." What Paul seems to be referring to here is when after he started the church in Philippi on his second journey, you know, he goes down to Thessalonica, starts a church there, goes down to Berea and then Athens and Corinth, that the Philippians were apparently already helping him to some degree financially to preach the gospel. In Acts 18, when Paul's in Corinth, he's working with his hands, right, building tents, making tents, until he's able to devote himself completely to the word. How's he able to do that? Maybe because the Philippians helped him out. They're willing to do that. They're eager to do that. And it's also the Macedonians, you know, Philippi is in Macedonia, that Paul in 2 Corinthians 8 says that they are eager, right, to give out of their poverty to help people they've never even met. These Jerusalem saints, these Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. As a way to share in what they need and share in their relationship with the Lord. What then can we base our motivation on? Well, verse 17. How can the Philippians do this? How can we do this? Because we have this assurance. Verse 17 says, "Not that I seek the gift, but I seek the fruit that increases to your credit." Now, I think in this verse, Paul is talking about the ultimate reward that will come in the resurrection. That God has provided, God will provide, it's a done deal. We will have what we need in a great abundance in the resurrection, right? When all God's people are saved in the ultimate sense and dwell with the Lord forever. He will provide for us. But in the meantime, as we use what God's given us in ways that honor Him, it's sort of like we're increasing our fruit or bearing fruit, you know, that we'll reap the benefits of that. We're storing up treasure in heaven. We're saying, I'm not devoted to the stuff here, right? I'm devoted to God and His purposes. Continue on with verses 18 and 19, Paul says, I have received full payment and more. I am well supplied, having received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God. And my God will supply every need of yours according to His riches and glory in Christ Jesus. To God, to our God and Father, be glory forever and ever. Amen. So now we have sort of a more immediate benefit. In verse 19, after Paul talks about that he's basically saying in financial terms, I've received the money you've given me in payment. This is my receipt saying I've got it and I'm thankful for it. It's a sacrifice to God, right? Your gift to me is a fragrant aroma, a fragrant offering, which is used consistently in the Old Testament as a sacrifice to God. And it pleases Him. So trust this, verse 19. God will take care of your present needs. Well, until the resurrection or until we die, God will take care of us. He'll provide for us. And you may have heard many stories of people losing everything, right? But they don't starve to death, right? They may lose a lot of the stuff they've accumulated. And that's a terrible thing to experience. But God provides what they need, and He provides for us. So let's think then about how we use our stuff, how God has called us to and taught us in His Word to use the provisions He's given us, and think very carefully about that. Let us not buy into the false notions of our culture that treat money as a god. You know, on our dollar bills, we have "In God We Trust." We kind of are, you know, mystified how somebody thousands of years ago could cut down a tree and with half of it used to start a fire to cook with or to keep their home warm, but then take the other half and make a figurine out of it and bow down to it and worship it. We cut down trees, and then they're made into these rectangles. They're green. Got some other colors on them now. And we have "In God We Trust," perhaps on the God that we trust in. We think that money can just solve problems that it can't. Recently, a couple of weeks ago, LeBron James, very wealthy athlete, and perhaps we could criticize maybe his greed and how he uses his money and his stuff. He's got multiple mansions, but on one of them, in L.A., a racial slur was spray painted on his gate. And we think, well, he's rich. Doesn't bother him. Shouldn't bother him. He's rich. You know, insults hurt. LeBron James was a human being made in the image of God. And who are we to say that did not affect him deeply? Nobody deserves that kind of treatment. What is able to help is the grace of God. And provisions He's made for us ultimately through Jesus Christ. And because of that, we can persevere. I am hesitant to use myself as an example, especially on this occasion, but perhaps it may be helpful to know that, you know, there are some people who live this and have to make tough decisions about money. And Katie and I have had to do that more than one occasion, more than one year. We have to look at what's coming in. All right, how are we going to use it? We have to go without. Not probably more so when we were first married. We wanted to pay off our school loans. We went to school, and we had over $20,000 to pay off, about $25,000, which is a lot less than many people. But how are we going to do that when, I'm not preaching at some congregation that can pay me lots of money. I'm preaching part-time. I'm working another part-time job. She's working a full-time job at a funeral home. Well, we just said we're going to live on this amount, and we're going to put as much as we can toward our loans. And we're able to pay it back. And we had to go without some material things. But, in those days, we weren't concerned about that. We were facing other struggles, much more serious than money. And every step of the way, the Lord has provided for us. One passage I'll want to close with is in Hebrews 13. I can't help but think of the greatest, for some of you may think this is an oxymoron, but the greatest country music band is Diamond Rio. Everybody knows that, right? Everybody knows Diamond Rio is the best? Okay. And they have a song called Stuff. And the chorus goes, stuff, stack it on up. Never gonna ever get enough. Stuff, oh, it's treasure till it's mine, then it ain't worth a dime. It's stuff, stuff, spreading like weeds, dragging me under in an endless sea of stuff, stuff. There ain't no wind, gotta get a bigger place so I can move in. More stuff. That's 16 years old, I think. They're in tune with what's going on in our society. But here's what Hebrews 13, verse 5 and 6 say. Keep your life free from love of money and be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?